From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. We've got a great show ahead for you today. We're racing through the summer here. It seems like the time is just flying by. And for those of us who live near Chicago, the cold weather is around. But let's just enjoy the summer while we can, shall we? We've got a good show, though. And speaking of cold weather, I think it's one of those things that, you know, when you've got a cold or you're feeling a cold, you're looking for some kind of soup, like chicken soup, maybe. And so that's the famous cold remedy anyway. There's a new book that's out that's part of the Chicken Soup for the Soul franchise. There are many, many books that have been published on that. And joining us on today's show will be Leanne Thiemann to talk to us about her new book, Chicken Soup for the Soul, Catholic Edition. So there are many incredible stories of miracles and marvels in that book, and I think it'll be inspiring to a lot of people, especially people who are fans of that Chicken Soup for the Soul series. And later in the show, we'll be talking about a very important indulgence, this miraculous set of events that related to St. Francis of Assisi at Portiuncula. And so we have this perhaps the most famous indulgence in the entire world, and that's called the Portiuncula Indulgence. And that's coming right around the corner. And Brett Thoman's going to join us today to talk about to Catholics about how we can take advantage of this incredible indulgence that's available in Italy and around the world. Later in the show, we'll be taking a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. For today, we've got the Virgin of Consolation from Huachana in Argentina in the year 1820. And of course, we always look at the might-be saint of the day. And for today, on July 31st, we've got Blessed John Colombini, born in Italy in the 14th century. And the question of the week is a good one. We have so many people writing in from all around the world to the Miracle Hunter webpage and account, and they ask about apparitions such as Medjugorje, but the other second most popular apparition people ask about is Garabandal in Spain in the 1960s. The church has never officially given a very definitive statement on that, so we've got a question from a listener who wants to know, where does the church stand on those alleged apparitions at Garabandal? So stay tuned for that answer. I'll do my best to answer that one. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We look at the miracles happening all around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And I always enjoy on this show talking about the biggest of miracles when there's a report of a Marian apparition or a Eucharistic miracle or something of this nature, where these occasions where the Catholic Church really validates these events. But as we all know from everyday life, there are smaller miracles. People might call them miracles with a lowercase m, as compared to those big miracles that I was just referencing. But we have a story like that that really caught my attention recently, and it got a ton of likes on my Facebook page. So you can connect to the Facebook feed of The Miracle Hunter in the future. You'll see I'll be posting stories of miracles big and small on there and things that relate to miracles. But one of the interesting stories that came up, that there was a story of a man who found his miraculous medal in the ocean after he lost it on vacation. And so this is an amazing story that nothing's impossible for God, the article says. And Gerard Marino has worn a miraculous medal around his neck ever since he was young. It was a gift from his mother. And miraculous medals relate to that St. Catherine Labouré apparition in France. And that's a popular thing. I wear one. I know many people who wear one as well. So when Gerard was swimming in the ocean 10 years ago, he lost his miraculous medal, this medal that meant so much to him. But one of his daughters found it buried under the sand when she saw something glistening in the water through her goggles. And recovering it was a lot like finding a needle in a haystack, he said, who's 46 years old, Gerard said. And he'd never imagined he'd be the recipient of the little miracle twice. And so that's an absolutely amazing thing. People can check out this article from Alitea. It's a good one, where we talk about this man, Gerard, who actually lost this medal in the ocean. I think we've all done that, swimming in the ocean, and we lose something, and you're never going to find it again. But there's this great article about this man through some prayer and some small miracle that miraculous medal resurfaced in a literal way for him. So check that one out. I've got that on the Facebook feed of The Miracle Hunter. Let's take a look at Catholic Club Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize for an emailer that gets the right answer, writing in the fastest. And last week, we had a great conversation with Father Ed Foley, talking about Father Solanus Casey, a blessed now in our Catholic Church. And he talked about his incredible life of faith and his miracle that was judged and found to be authentic, and that led to his beatification. And so we asked the question, who was the most recently beatified person before Father Michael McGivney? Because he happened on October 31st of this past year, so he's in everybody's mind. So I asked for the one prior to that, and that answer is Father Solanus Casey, the one we talked about on the show. So people can find out more about Father Solanus if they tune into the audio archive, which is available on the EWTN.com/radio website. Search for Miracle Hunter, or they can download the free app to listen to that as well. And other people wrote in talking about Blessed Miriam Teresa Demjanovic, who was beatified in 2014. So she's also a very recent candidate for that. So here's a question for this week. We're talking about chicken soup for the soul. And so we'll ask you a biblical food question. So Jacob and Esau were twins who famously ate the meal named a mess of pottage in the Bible. And what exactly were they eating? So again, that question, we're talking about chicken soup for the soul today, but how about some food found in the Bible? Jacob and Esau were twins who famously ate the meal described as a mess of pottage in the Bible. And what exactly were they eating? If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or go through my website, miraclehunter.com, and we'll see if you've got the right answer and are the fastest. And answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about chicken soup for the soul for Catholics. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill and the Miracle Hunter. We all have stories of miracles in our lives, don't we? Stories big and small, we might say. For us personally, they might be miracles. They might be significant moments where we really see God looking down on us as a loving father. They might not be the kind of miracles with a capital M that the Catholic Church investigates perhaps for canonization causes or other types of things that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith will send out investigators and investigate. But we all have these moments, don't we, that where we really feel the love of God in our lives. And there's a new book in the popular series called Chicken Soup for the Soul, and it is the Catholic edition of this book. And you've all heard this. This is a widely known and widely popular book series, Chicken Soup for the Soul. And we're so excited today to welcome the author of that book, and that's Leanne Thiemann. Welcome to the show today, Leanne.
Thank you. Good. Wonderful to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for sharing your experience with this series and this book. And tell us a little bit. I know that many people are familiar with this Chicken Soup for the Soul series, and it's wildly popular. What was the concept behind looking at Catholics or the Catholic experiences of Chicken Soup for the Soul?
Well, it was interesting. I had co-authored Chicken Soup for the Christian Woman's Soul and a Chicken Soup for the Christian Soul. And that's when, actually, the secular publisher at the time, Chicken Soup Enterprises, called and asked if I would author Chicken Soup for the Catholic Soul, very specifically. And at first I thought, I wonder if we really need a whole separate book just for Catholics. and then I certainly realized we surely did. So we just put out a call, and that's what we do, is to everybody who's ever contributed a story ever to Chicken Soup, and to all of their people on their newsletter list, to send in their stories. And I believe it or not, I read 2,000 stories from Catholics in order to write Chicken Soup for the Soul, Chicken Soup for the Soul Living Catholic Faith. And then we had so many wonderful stories left over, I called them and said, we can do Chicken Soup for the Soul, a Book of Miracles. And we did. And then I said, we still have great stories from all these Catholics. And we did Chicken Soup for the Soul, Answered Prayers. And then the wonderful thing is Sophia Institute Press took those three books and from that made a four-book series just especially for Catholics and for the Catholic press.
Wonderful. Well, it's an exciting thing to shine the light on Catholic miracles and Catholic experiences. I think for all the listeners of this show, they're very interested in that. And so, while we sort of get the feel of Chicken Soup for the Soul based on all the previous books and efforts that have been put out, what would you say was the something that was unique other than just having the Catholic title on the book? What was unique in the experiences that are contained in these books?
I was privileged to be able to make sure that there were stories about just about every one of our sacraments. That was something different from everything from funny kids' experiences in confessionals to Holy Saturday to weddings and a wonderful fun story about priests. And so I think that's probably part of the uniqueness about it. I'm not sure, and of course we could have lots of stories about the Virgin Mary and our saints that not every other religion appreciates as much.
That's right. We're talking today with Leanne Thiemann about the book Chicken Soup for the Soul, Catholic Edition. And, you know, we talk a lot about miracles on this show, and I know that this book and other related books talk about miracles. What was a favorite story or two from the Catholic Edition that you thought seemed downright miraculous?
Well, we had stories of everything that some people would call a God wink, or I call them divine coincidences. And others that actually had apparitions of St. Michael the Archangel standing 30 feet tall. So the variety is what was so amazing as well. I have to say one of my favorite stories was actually from my mother. And I was so honored to be able to put it in the book. Mom was 80 when she went on a pilgrimage. And immediately when they got there, all the young people, she was, of course, the oldest one, they started walking up the hill already. It was raining, and Mother said, well, I'm going with you. And indeed, she did. And the next morning, though, they always have a plan to take 30 bags of groceries to 30 needy families in the area. So Mother was a part of them as they loaded these 30 bags into the back of a big old bus. And they drove from house to house distributing these gifts. And she said it was just heart-wrenching sometimes that some of the homes were ramshackle and torn down and some bombed by war and some with severely disabled and disfigured people. And yet each of these people, at every place they stopped, wanted to gift Mother and the pilgrimage with small gifts from their own. Then they went from house to house, and the bus driver started to pull up to one house where a man and a young boy came running out to the curb, and the tour director said, they're not on our list today. They're not on our list. We can't stop here. Well, he had nearly stopped. He said, you have to pull away. If we do, if we don't pull away, we're going to be depriving somebody else a basket that we promised. So everybody's heart was just aching as this bus pulled away and this man and boy just stood there. So they counted their 30 bags and took them to 30 different houses. They gave it to the 30th house and turned around and looked in the back of the bus. There was one more bag. And I love the end of the book, the end of the story. They drove back to the house with the boy and the young man, and they came running out to the curb again as if they were expecting them.
Amazing. Yeah, the stories found in this book will warm your heart and soul, as the Chicken Soup for the Soul title might imply. We're talking today with Leanne Thiemann about the new edition, the Catholic edition of Catholic Soup for the Soul. And what has been the response to this book, Chicken Soup for the Soul, maybe especially from Catholics? How are people responding to these great stories of inspiration?
Everybody from a cradle Catholic to a recently convert. I especially hear from people whose faith had been wavering. People tell me that it renews the faith I have and rekindles the faith I have today. And other people tell me that the stories of help them when they are struggling with their faith. I have had many people tell me they have given them to their, often it's to children or people that they know that have fallen away from the faith and are no longer practicing, and they read these stories. And I think that's the beauty of it all. They see the goodness of God and in the goodness of the Catholic Church. And I think that's part of our mission, is to share with all the bad press that we get all the greatness and the goodness of the Catholic Church.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Leanne Thiemann about Chicken Soup for the Soul, Catholic Edition. And if you're willing, tell a story from the book that relates to someone finding their faith again, somebody who had lost it and through some series of circumstances were led back to re-engage with the faith.
Well, there was a wonderful story about a person, about a young man who just went begrudgingly day after day and Sunday after Sunday with his parents when he was a teenager. And as soon as he got off on his own, he surely stopped going to Mass again because he never wanted to do that again. And his dad had never been a Catholic, but he always supported taking the kids, his mother taking the kids to church all the time. And the young boy, as a teenager, used to kind of envy his dad. Good thing he doesn't have to go every Sunday because Mom makes us go, and even Dad makes us go, but he doesn't have to go. And unbelievably, when the young man was in college, his dad started attending RCIA and went and joined the Catholic Church. And when the young man witnessed that and was there present when his dad was baptized and received communion and confirmed on Holy Saturday, that was the day that the young man came back to the church.
Wow.
And realized that the beauty of it all, and ceased his rebellion and followed his dad back to the faith.
Hey, that's a great story. We're talking today with Leanne Deeman about Chicken Soup for the Soul, Catholic edition, and there are in the book are incredible miracle stories and stories of conversion and otherwise that people can really turn to, and maybe it'll inspire their faith. And so, when we talk about miracle stories, why do you think they are important to believers of any stripe? Why are miracle stories sort of this touchstone that kind of turn people around or inspire people or at least pique their interest? Why are miracles so important?
I think just the reality of the realization of them all. At the foreword to the book, I wrote my mother had gone on a retreat when she was a young woman, Catholic, and she raising her children, and she said to the Monsignor, God did so many miracles, Jesus did on earth. Why we need miracles today? Why doesn't he do miracles now when we need them the most? And the Monsignor said, every day there are miracles before us, and we just fail to see them. We explain them away with science or with coincidence. Or now, it is, of course, it is trying to, if you can't scientifically prove it, then it can't be true. And I think that's the beauty of the stories, is that it's just that the realization of God's presence in our lives. And it brings me to tears often when I think he just must love us so much that he makes these little coincidences and these miracles throughout our days if we pay attention.
That's right. I think we can all feel God's embrace, God's care for us when we experience these miracles, big and small, all around the world. And so as we wrap up the show today, I know this book fits in very well with the series Catholic Soup for the Soul, and it goes right down the middle of what this series has attempted to accomplish through the years, and has been such a great inspiration for so many people. Millions of people around the world have loved these books. What is your hope specifically for this Catholic edition of Chicken Soup for the Soul?
That the Catholics really read, I always say, I wish people would read one story every day. Because I think it really is difficult today sometimes to keep our faith rekindled and strong with all of the negativity in the world. Every single story in every single Chicken Soup book has a message of hope. Even if it's a sad story about a loss, and there has to be some of that, of course, and of death occasionally, but the miraculous things that happen at that moment of people dying and the images that people in the room have seen, and all of these true stories, that is my goal. Thank you for asking, is just that when people read these stories, you can just not fail to see God's action in our lives and his absolutely demonstration of love for us. And the more we can see that, I think the better we and our whole world will be.
Wonderful. And so I imagine these books will be available anywhere Catholic books are sold, but what is the best place for people to find out more about these new books and to purchase the book? Where can they go?
You're absolutely right. Sophia Institute Press has them on their website. I have them on my website. They are on every Amazon. That's easy. At Barnes & Noble, on all the websites, they will be available to be ordered in every bookstore.
Wonderful. Well, we've been so grateful to you, Leanne Deeman, author of the book Catholic Soup for the Soul, Catholic Edition, for joining us on today's program. Thank you for your great work, and God bless you.
He certainly does, over and over. Thank you very much.
God bless. That was Leanne Thiemann, author of Chicken Soup for the Soul, Catholic Edition. Check that one out. Stories of Inspirations, Miracles Big and Small are documented in that book. And like she said, she read through 2,000 reports of miracles from Catholics all around the world. So the ones that made it into this book are good ones. So you're really going to enjoy that. Check that out from Sophia Institute Press. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. What about the apparitions at Garabandal? What does the Catholic Church say? Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I love getting your questions. People write in with questions from around the world about questions about miracles, things that have happened in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And I love answering questions every time I give a talk at a parish or a conference. I always leave a little time, both at the end of the talk and at my table, where people come and they ask questions about miracles happening in their own lives. So send me an email with questions, either to speak at your parish or questions you have about miracles. And so this past week, I got a great question, and it's a common one in some ways, because I get so many messages to my inbox related to current apparitions and past apparitions and the whole thing. But Our Lady of Medjugorje, as she's called, the alleged apparitions from 1981 in Bosnia-Herzegovina, are certainly the most popular of the apparitions that people ask about, or the most commonly asked about. But people also talk about these apparitions from Garabandal, apparitions in 1961 in Spain. So the question was from Dan. He said, can you provide any information on the church's pronouncements or findings on the apparition of Garabandal? Also, the visionary Conchita Gonzalez, I believe, is still alive and says things from time to time. Is there any information on her or whether she has been found to be in conflict with church teaching or found to have given false prophecies? I greatly appreciate any information you can provide. Thank you, and God bless, Dan. Well, thanks, Dan, for your great question. And again, many people are interested in this, so I'll try my best to answer it. And I'll answer that second part first. The visionary Conchita, she is still alive, and occasionally she has said things, but there's been nothing that the church has flagged and said that this is the proof that this is not an authentic apparition based on the things that she has said after the apparition. So that's an easy one to answer. But the more complicated thing is, what about after the apparitions, how has the church responded? So just for a little bit of background, the Garabandal apparitions are alleged apparitions of St. Michael the Archangel and the Blessed Virgin Mary that were claimed to have occurred from 1961 to 1965 to four young schoolgirls in this village of San Sebastián de Garabandal in the Peña Sagra mountain region of the in part of Cantabria in northern Spain. And these alleged apparitions happened on many occasions, hundreds or thousands of times. Big crowds gathered there. There's some very interesting footage and photographs that were taken. So I think a lot of people are excited about these because of some of the documentation that was done. And the events, they started on June 18th, 1961. And the four girls, they were 11 and 12 years old. Mariloli Mason was one of them. Jacinta Gonzalez was one. Maricruz Gonzalez and Maria Conchita, as she's known, Concepcion Gonzalez. Those were the four who on that day said they first saw an angel. And their claims, like I said, went on for 4 years. And the Bishop of Santander, the local ordinary there, he determined a non-constat judgment. That means not established as supernatural. So that means they can neither be confirmed nor denied. It is just not established as supernatural. If they were to have said constat de non supernaturalitate, they would be saying established as not supernatural. So regarding these alleged apparitions at Garabandal, Bishop Vilplana stated that all the bishops of the diocese from 1961 through 1970 asserted that the supernatural character of the said apparitions that took place around that time could not be confirmed. No constaba in Spanish. And no further He further expressed his opinion that he did not find it necessary to reiterate this in a new declaration and give undue publicity to something which happened so long ago. And so there are other letters dated in 1970 and 1996. The Sacred Congregation of the Faith wrote a letter to the Bishop of Santander, and he said, promoters of Garabandal movement have tried to minimize the decisions and jurisdiction of the Bishop of Santander. The congregation wants to be clearly understood that the Bishop of Santander has been and continues to be the only one with complete jurisdiction in this matter, and the Holy See has no intention of examining this question any further. And so it goes on, it just goes on to say that it is still not established as supernatural. And beyond that 1996 statement, there has been no further movement on Garabandal, no bishop statements, and there's been no further sort of reinvestigation of the matter. And so what many devotees of Garabandal will hold on to are some of the prophecies that relate to a warning and a sign, perhaps, similar to Medjugorje, where there's sort of, as a part of the apparitions, there's some sort of a proof or some sort of an endpoint that comes up at the end. So for all those people who are either willing to dismiss those statements of the church or waiting for the next one, the real proof will be in the pudding, so to speak, when these events supposedly transpire. Just like at Medjugorje, there are things predicted for the future. If those things start to happen, we'll know that they're true. If they never happen, we'll know that it's been false. So thank you so much, Dan, for your question and giving me a chance to talk about Garabandal. If you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and send me a message. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion. It lines up exactly to the day's date. We all know the Marian devotions of Fatima on May 13th or Lourdes, February 11th, or Guadalupe, December 12th. But believe it or not, there's a different Marian devotion for each and every day of the calendar year. And so for today's date, we've got the Virgin of Consolation from Huachana in Argentina in the year 1820. And the story goes that in 1820, a girl named Telesfora Verón told her family about the Virgin appearing in the solitude of the mountain, but no one believed her. After becoming tired of being taken for being crazy, she never went home again. And one night, the neighbors decided to meet at the place of the apparitions and waited in the cold with a fire. At dawn, Mary surprised them and gave them her image. And her brother moved the small image to his humble home, where for many years, thousands of devotees came to venerate the Virgin. And today, with celebrations by the Bishopric of Antuya, nearly 100,000 pilgrims from all over Argentina arrive every year to honor the Virgin at the place where Mary chose to announce her love for all. And that is the Virgin of Consolation in Huachana in Argentina in the year 1820. And if you want more information on this fascinating devotion or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, connect to the website 365dayswithmary.com, pick up the book by that name, download the app, or join any of the 10,000 followers of 365 Days with Mary on Facebook. Now it's time for the might-be saint of the day. We do this every week where we look at the might-be saint of the day. Those are people on the path to sainthood. Those are servants of God, venerables, and blesseds, people who aren't quite saints, who might be saints someday. And it lines up to my television show where we examine the lives of Americans on the path to sainthood. As I like to say, from miracle workers to martyrs to those ordinary people living extraordinary lives of heroic virtue, these are the people that make us wonder if someday they might be saints. And for people who want to see that show on Mondays at 10:30 a.m. Eastern or Fridays 5 p.m. Eastern every week on EWTN Television, you can tune in and see a new episode of They Might Be Saints. So for today's date, July 31st, we've got Blessed John Colombini, or Giovanni Colombini, as he was probably known at his time. He was born in Italy, in Siena, around the year 1300. And so he was known to be wealthy and greedy and ambitious and ill-tempered, and he was the son of a patrician family. So he was a married layman, he was the father of two children, and his son Peter and daughter Angela were his two children. He was the first magistrate in Siena. And with his family and friends, he alternated between bouts of anger and consequent periods of mortification and self-loathing. And he converted to the faith while reading the story of the conversion of Saint Mary of Egypt. And he reformed his personal and business life. He visited hospitals. He tended to the sick. He gave to the poor. And he personally looked after the poorest and most forgotten in his society. And several years into his new life, John's son died, and his daughter became a nun. He established a fund that allowed his wife to live in comfort and use the rest of his wealth to endow a hospital and two convents. From then on, he lived in poverty, begged for his own bread from day to day, and he soon attracted followers, many of them young men from wealthy families who were sort of unsatisfied with their lives, and he felt a call to God to give away, and they felt a call to give away their wealth. So the patrician class demanded John's exile, as he was leading the city's most promising young men to quote-unquote folly. And he founded a small group of laymen called the Jesuati, or Jesuits, after their habit of saying, "Praise be Jesus Christ," about everything. They were devoted to penance and charity and had a special devotion to St. Jerome. And the group received approval from Pope Urban V in 1367, just 37 days before John's death. It survived until 1668, when the sisters were founded by John's cousin, Blessed Catherine of Colombini. And it survived until 1872, when it disappeared due to attrition. So, Blessed John Colombini, he died on July 31st, 1367, of natural causes, and he was beatified by Pope Gregory XIII. That's the fascinating life of Blessed John Colombini, our might-be saint of the day for July 31st. And for more information on Blessed John or any other people that we cover on the show, They Might Be Saints, check out the website, theymightbesaints.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Brett Thoman about the Porciuncula indulgence. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. We have this phenomenon in our church, or this practice, as you might say, of indulgences. And that's something that, of course, during the Protestant Revolt or Reformation, that was a big question mark. And the question is, do indulgences still, or are they still in use by the Catholic Church, even in this modern age? And the answer is yes. And perhaps the greatest, or maybe the most powerful, or the most interesting indulgence relates to Porciuncula, which is a place in Assisi, and that is, relates to the work of St. Francis there. And that indulgence, which goes underway from sunset on August 1st, goes until the sunset of August 2nd. And that is when that indulgence is available. So we're going to be talking today with Brett Thoman, author of numerous Catholic books related to Assisi and Italy, and he takes people on pilgrimages to Italy. So he's a real expert on everything St. Francis. So we'll be talking to him today about this this big indulgence day coming up on August 2nd and how people can get it. So stay tuned for that. And so we're excited today to chat with one of our favorite guests, and that's Brett Thoman. Welcome back to the show today, Brett.
Okay, well, thanks for having me.
So when we talk about this indulgence, this name Porciuncula, depending on how you might pronounce it, this is a big one. I mean, I think you talk to Italians and they get really excited about this feast day, or this indulgence day. So what actually is this Porciuncula? And if you would, talk about sort of the beginnings. It didn't begin with St. Francis, did it? What is this place that we're talciuncula about here?
Sure. The Porciuncula, it's an Italian word, an old Italian word, even an Umbrian dialect word, meaning a little portion of land. So if you've ever been to Assisi, you're aware that there's kind of two areas of Assisi. There's the old Assisi up on the hill, and then there's the lower part of Assisi, which is called St. Mary of the Angels. So St. Mary of the Angels is the real name for this church. Porciuncula, the little portion of land, is sort of the slang name for it. So it was in Francis's era, really back in the 1200s, late 1100s, there was a little church, a little country church on the road going into Assisi, and St. Francis was very devoted to that church. He was actually in love with that church, and he loved the simplicity of it. So after his conversion and after other men started following him, they eventually made this little church their sort of home base, and they eventually erected kind of a fence around it, maybe a couple, 2 acres, maybe 3 acres or so, and that became their home base as the community grew. And as a matter of fact, it's still the mother church of the Franciscan order today, at least the OFM branch of the Franciscan order. So Porciuncula means little portion of land, And it's a very important church to St. Francis and the Franciscan order.
That's so interesting. I bet most people don't know that. One of the miraculous experiences of St. Francis, and we talk about him with the stigmata and otherwise, as this great miracle-working saint, this saint who had experiences that were miraculous, supernatural experiences. We know this sort of scene at San Damiano, and there still is a famous crucifix that exists, the San Damiano crucifix, and you'll see it in the home of many Italians and Catholics. Otherwise, people still remember this moment, and he heard the voice of God asking him to rebuild his church at this time. And that church he interpreted to be the rundown place that he was receiving this vision. That was sort of the literal interpretation. But he also went and wanted to reform the church in a larger way. But he still went on to rebuild some of these smaller churches around Assisi. And one of them was the Porciuncula Church. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, San Damiano is closer to Assisi from these two areas of Assisi, the lower portion, St. Mary of the Angels, and the upper portion, the old part of town. So San Damiano is also another country church, and it's on a hill a little bit to the south between St. Mary of the Angels and Assisi. So in the beginning, before people were even following him, St. Francis was rebuilding this church, and he had sort of a premonition, or he heard a voice that came from this crucifix inside San Damiano. And it said, "Francis, Francis, go and rebuild this church, which, as you can see, is totally in ruin." So the small church of San Damiano was in ruin. So Francis, you know, promptly started to rebuild it, reconstruct it. Historians don't know the degree to which it was in ruin, nor do they know the degree to which St. Francis himself personally rebuilt this church. But he did rebuild it to one degree or another. And some have speculated that the voice of Jesus speaking to him was saying, you know, rebuild the entire church, the Catholic Church, which was, you know, spiritually possibly in ruin. But I think Francis was doing exactly what that voice instructed him to do. He was rebuilding that church because, you know, we don't go off and do huge, grandiose things. The Lord usually asks us to do one small step at a time. And then after you've done each of those small steps that God has asked you to do or asked us to do, we can look back, you know, the years of our life, and we can see possibly we did great things. So eventually that command to rebuild this little church of San Damiano was expanded into how Francis helped rebuild the entire Catholic Church, the Universal Catholic Church, through his order, his mendicant order. And also, too, there were two other churches that Francis sort of moved on to and started to reconstruct. The other one was the Porciuncula, which we're talking about now. Mainly, we're talking about the Porciuncula and the pardon of the Porciuncula. And then there was another one, another smaller ruined church near Rivotorto, kind of, again, on the plains of Assisi, the outskirts of Assisi. Two of those churches, San Damiano is still in, at least there's a presence of the friars. There's a community of Franciscan friars there. It's a very important church in the history of the order. And the Porciuncula, as I said before, is the mother church of the order. The third church is kind of fallen into ruin again, and it's actually on private property, and there's a horse farm there. But that was the third church that Francis rebuilt.
So I know you lead many pilgrimages. You take people with you to Italy, to the various places, and Assisi is one of the places that you really focus on. And so if you were to take people on a pilgrimage and they visited Porciuncula today, in this day and age, what would you see? If you would, just sort of describe the look of the church from the inside and the out. What would be the experience be like?
Yeah, in Assisi, or at least for pilgrimages to Assisi, you're going to stop most likely at least three main places: the Basilica of St. Francis, Basilica of St. Clair, and the Basilica of St. Mary of the Angels. So it's a very important church. Today, it's a Renaissance-era church. It's a large church, a huge basilica. And underneath it, directly underneath the cupola, the dome, is the original small country wayside church of the Porciuncula. It's not richly decorated as some of the other Franciscan churches are. And it can come across to some as being this grandiose space, this grandiose church, and people will say, well, Francis was the saint of, you know, humility and poverty and simplicity, and we've got this great, majestic Renaissance, you know, era church. But on the other hand, that church was so important, there needed to be constructed a large basilica over it in order to accommodate the crowds, because since at least Francis's lifetime, the Pope instituted the pardon of the Porciuncula, which we'll talk about. And it was important to have a church that could accommodate these great crowds. So the two things happened. One, the plenary indulgence was instituted and attached to a pilgrimage to this small church. And two, St. Francis himself was canonized. So from that moment on, the 1220s, late 1220s, Assisi became a very important pilgrimage destination. So there's a very large church in St. Mary of the Angels that accommodates or houses the small church of the Porciuncula. And also, too, I lived in Assisi for 2 years. And every Sunday, there are about 7 or 8 masses on Sunday, 2 vigil masses on Saturday, and they're all full. So that space is very important for the community, the local community of Assisi today.
And so I know that Pope Pius X, he raised this to a basilica level. It's a papal chapel. It's a big deal. That was in the early 1900s. And so that this place is important in church history. But we also have, you know, this concept of the indulgence on August 2nd, the biggest or greatest or most well-known indulgence around the world is this Porciuncula indulgence. So I guess let's dial it back a little bit for non-Catholic listeners or for Catholics who aren't familiar with this almost archaic concept that we don't see talked about as much in our church today. What is an indulgence according to Catholic belief? And how does that connect with Porciuncula? And how did it come to be this indulgence there? And is it still in use today, even after all the church reforms of indulgences over the years? Talk a little bit about specifically indulgences and the Porciuncula indulgence.
An indulgence, according to Catholic teaching, it's in the catechism. And sometimes people will think, well, Vatican II took away the teaching on indulgence. That's not true. An indulgence is a it's a remission for the temporary punishment due to a sin that has already been forgiven. Complex, maybe theological argument, maybe it seems like you're pulling hairs. You can look it up in the Catechism of the Catholic Church to get a little bit more of a formal answer. But in a sense, we are forgiven through the sacraments, sacrament of reconciliation for serious sins, sacrament of Eucharist for venial sins, the anointing of the sick also, but there's still a punishment due, if you will, a remission that has to take place. Now, before Vatican II, and we all know during the Protestant Reformation that this was a very important theological issue, the Protestant Reformation really broke off really because of this issue and the fact that they were, you know, using the quote-unquote term selling indulgences, which basically the different people in the church, organizations, orders were asking for money that would help to remit that sin. So that was a big part of the Protestant Reformation. But also pilgrimages were an important part of this indulgence. And so a lot of times people who had committed serious sins would go to confession, and the confessor would give the penitent a penance of going on a pilgrimage. So at the time of the 1220s, there were 3 or 4 main places where a Catholic could go and do penance and receive a plenary indulgence. Plenary indulgence means a full indulgence. That means a complete remission, wiping away of all sins that have ever been committed that would bring one back to the state of baptism. And the main places one could go would be St. Peter's or St. Paul's in Rome, St. James in Compostela in northwestern Spain, a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, or even one of the popes established plenary indulgence to crusaders fighting in the Holy Land. There was also, I believe it was in France, St. Mary Magdalene, I believe, in southern France. So there were 4 places you could go, five places you could go to receive this plenary indulgence. St. Francis had a vision in which Mary appeared to him and asked what he wanted her to petition Jesus for. And Francis wanted all people to be saved. So he said, I request that anyone who comes to this small, humble, little church of the Porciuncula, this was long before the large basilica was built, and they receive a plenary indulgence. So Mary said to Francis, go and ask the Pope, and it was Pope Honorius at the time. Francis sent that petition out, and the Pope granted a plenary indulgence to be attached to the church of the Porciuncula. This was kind of a wild idea because, as I mentioned, those 4 or 5 places, traditionally, one would receive a plenary indulgence in that era, were big, huge, very important churches. Here we are talking about a little wayside country church that's probably 10, 15 feet across,
20, 25 feet deep, a tiny little church, maybe 20, 25 feet high. And the Pope agreed to it, but then there was kind of an outcry from the other major places where one could receive the plenary indulgence, sort of a pushback. So the Pope reduced that plenary indulgence to one day a year, which was August 2nd, okay? So the terms of receiving the plenary indulgence at the Portiuncula initially were just go to the church, okay? And in the Middle Ages, the 1200s, traveling long distances were very difficult, okay? You either walked, which was sort of the penitential tradition, or you took a horse, or maybe a carriage, or rode a donkey. So it was very difficult to travel long distances. It took weeks at a time, months at a time. So the most important thing was you get there. Two, pray for the Pope. Three, pray the formula of the plenary indulgence. And you also have to make confession and receive Eucharist within 7 days of on either side of getting there, either before or after you get there, and you would receive the plenary indulgence. So after the outcry came up, the Pope reduced it to August 2nd. So August 2nd is the traditional date for receiving the plenary indulgence. And in later centuries, it was again expanded to any calendar day throughout the year. So today, anyone who goes to Assisi and, you know, meets those criteria or makes those, does what's required, can receive the plenary indulgence of the Portiuncula.
So I know that you lead pilgrimages to Italy, and your specialty is Assisi. You've written numerous books about Claire and Francis and Assisi in general. So I know that you both are an expert on it, and you bring that expertise when you lead pilgrimages in Italy. So, of course, I lead pilgrimages as well, and I've been acutely aware of this pandemic, how it's affected, the travel worldwide. And many Catholics still want to go on pilgrimages, but everybody's nervous with this Delta variant of the coronavirus, et cetera. And so I just was curious, from your perspective as a professional pilgrimage leader, what are your thoughts when we look at Italy specifically? Are we moving on from the pandemic and with some surges in the horizon? What do we see regarding pilgrimages in the future?
That's such a good question, and that is the question that has been on everyone's mind for, a year and a half now. We're going on 18 months. We've been trying to be positive, and I've been organizing pilgrimages for almost 20 years, and this, last year we canceled all our pilgrimages. This year, it looks like I'm going to be canceling our pilgrimages. We just, quite frankly, don't know. Sometimes it kind of seems like that carrot on the stick, and you're sort of chasing it, and then just keeps getting moved, further away in front of you. And it's appearing that this one of these variants that's out there, this Delta variant, is causing problems again. So we're hopeful, and I should say this right now: tourism or leisure travel is open in Italy for Americans. We're on what's called the green list. So if you've been vaccinated, or if you've had the virus within the previous 6 months and you can prove recovery from it, or you take a nose swab test within 48 hours of arrival, you can come to Italy and you do not have to quarantine, and you can make a pilgrimage in Italy. And then the CDC requires going back to the U.S. that within 3 days of departure, you have to have another nasal swab and have to be negative to go back. So there are these conditions. The doors finally opened up, it was really about a month ago, and we're hopeful that they'll stay open, but people keep talking about what's going to happen this fall. Are we going to have a fourth wave, fifth wave, whatever? So we're faithful, and we hope in God's providence, and we know that there's good that's coming out of this, but there are a lot of questions right now.
And as I mentioned, many people are interested in pilgrimages, and you are the expert when it comes to Assisi and pilgrimages to Italy. You're a great guy to go on a pilgrimage with. How can people find out more about you personally in these various books you've written and the pilgrimages that you're leading people on?
You can go to my website, stfrancispilgrimages.com. That's S-T-Francis, Francis with I-S, pilgrimages, plural, .com. And I've got a number of books that I've written, one on St. Francis, one on St. Clair. A new book on Padre Pio and the pandemic that is recently translated and published. And another book that I just recently wrote within the past week or so, just released it on Amazon, about St. Maria Goretti. So they're all on there, and there's links that you can click and get access to that.
We've been talking today with Brett Thoman, author of numerous Catholic books on Assisi, St. Francis, St. Clair, and also a great pilgrimage leader for people who want to visit Italy and see some of these incredible places of St. Francis and otherwise. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio, look for Miracle Hunter, check out the audio archives, or you can download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank my guest, Leanne Thiemann, the author of Chicken Soup for the Soul, Catholic Edition, and Brett Thoman, talking to us about that amazing Portiuncula indulgence. And sign-ups are ending now for the pilgrimage to France, going October 18th through 27th. Marian Shrines of France, including Pontmain, celebrating the 150th anniversary, and La Salette celebrating the 175th anniversary this year in 2021. Of course, we'll be going to Lourdes and to Lisieux and to see the Chapel of the Miraculous Medal and all the places of Marian miracles all over France. So if you're interested in joining us, check out nativitypilgrimage.com/miraclehunter for more information and to sign up. And sign up for the newsletter on miraclehunter.com for more information on miracle stories, where I'll be speaking next, upcoming book releases, and more. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.
EWTN Radio posts 11 podcasts every weekday and over 70 per week. Never miss your favorite EWTN radio show. Go to EWTN.com/radio/podcast.